Welcome to the 13 Skulls. A journey into a world that is just beyond our comprehension. The world of the paranormal.
Hey everybody, in today's episode we're going to take a look at a listener email that was sent in to me about a creepy experience with a frail dark figure and possible lost time, a mysterious pyramid complex that was discovered in Peru, a possible UFO robot ship that's been discovered, and is Area 51 now Area 6413 in Utah? Have scientists discovered a way to peer into the future? Well, we'll take a look at all this and quite a bit more than that coming up on this 12th episode of the 13 Skulls Podcast. One thing wrong, you're never in my head. Can't break! And the strength in the unknown is what keeps me from being alone. All right, everybody. Well, thanks for joining me today. I really do appreciate it. First things first, let me just say that I apologize for the time that it's taken to get this show out. Had a lot of issues lately. I won't go into any excuses, but man, I tell you what, computers are just a pain in the butt. They really, really are. You know, they're a lifesaver. They make the world go round these days, but man, I tell you what, they can be either your best friend or your worst nightmare. Anyway, well, let's get through some of the formalities here. If you want to email the show, the email is the13skulls@gmail.com. And before I go any further with that, first I want to say that I think for some people there might be some confusion as to the name of the show. The name of the show is not 13 Skulls Podcast. It's the 13 Skulls Podcast. I know I don't want to be picky here. I don't want to be an ass. I don't want to sound like I'm, you know, want to make sure you get the name of the show right. But, you know, I mean, some people, have left off the at the beginning of the 13 Skulls Podcast. The email is the13skulls@gmail.com. You have to put in the THE there. I know there's been a slight bit of confusion with a couple of different people that thought it was just 13 Skulls. It's actually the 13 Skulls, referring to the 13 crystal skulls that are out there. Anyway, we won't go into that, but I wanted to just kind of get that out of the way and let you guys know, you know, that it is the 13 Skulls Podcast. It's the 13 Skulls or the13skulls@gmail.com. That's the email. Anyway, the phone numbers are 206-338-2205. And the reason I say that there are phone numbers, for any of you who don't know out there quite yet, there is a new local phone number for anybody here in the DFW area that wants to give the show a call, and it's 817-986-0019. Now, anybody can call that number. I don't think it's going to be long distance or anything, because it's not actually it's a real phone line, but nobody's going to answer it. It's going to be a voicemail. So anyway, the phone numbers are 206-338-2205. And for anybody here in the DFW area that wants to call, it's 817-986-0019. Leave me your feedback, voicemail of any kind, you know, share your experiences with me. I love to hear people's experiences. So just send them to me. You know, I love to hear from the listeners of this show. But anyway, if you want, sign the Frapper map. I love to know where people live too. You know, if you don't feel like calling in, you still want to to let me know where you live, you know, sign the Frapper map. There's a link to it on both the sidebars of the13skulls.com and the13skulls@podomatic.com. Another thing, it's a different month now. If you want to give the show a vote on Podcast Alley, I'd appreciate it. You know, please do. I'd greatly appreciate the acknowledgement that you would want it to give the show a vote. Also, we're also listed on iTunes. If anybody wants to go and look up, just type in the 13 Skulls and it'll come up in iTunes, and, you know, write a review for the show. I'd love to hear about it. You know, I'd love to see what people's reviews are of the show and what they think about it. Even though I'm doing this show just for fun, I still like to know what kind of feedback, you know, people have about the show. And there's two websites that I want to give a shout out to real quick. And the first one is the Obscure 80s Podcast. And the Obscure 80s Podcast is basically that. They talk about obscure stuff that came from the 1980s. I know personally that I loved the 80s. I mean, they were an odd era of time. I mean, it was a strange decade, to say the least. And, you know, I grew up in it. I mean, I was born in 75, so from the age of 5 till 15, I grew up in the 80s. So, you know, I love listening to this stuff. They bring back a lot of memories. So if you guys want something that's not necessarily paranormal, but something that's fun to listen to, I do have to admit it is more of an adult show. There is language in it. They do, you know, they don't edit themselves out with that. And sorry, I can't talk today, but anyway, go listen to it. TheObscure80s.com. Let me rephrase that. It's Obscure80s.com, and their Podomatic site is obscure80s.podomatic.com. I don't think they're going to be with Podomatic for too much longer from what I've heard them say, but anyway, go to obscure80s.com, and there's no apostrophe there. It's just obscure80s.com, obscure80s.com. It's a great website. And also want to give a shout out to jeremybaugh.com. Now, Jeremy's a friend of mine, and I just wanted to take a minute to say thank you, Jeremy, for helping make the show sound better than it ever has. I won't necessarily say what Jeremy did to help make the show sound better due to certain issues that could arise from that, but I wanted to make sure that he got all the credit he deserves for helping the show out as much as he has. So everyone, if you need any info on anything entertaining, I mean, he has all kinds of different stuff on there, from video games to movies to reviews. He takes out all the crap and gives you just the information that you really, really need. And that's jeremybaugh.com, jeremybaugh.com. And like I said, he always has new content coming out, about anything and everything that makes our lives enjoyable, you know. I don't know about you guys, but I love movies. I love video games. I love, you know, hearing about all this new stuff that's coming out. And trust me, he's good. You need to go give his site a view and see what you think. But anyway, that's jeremybaugh.com. And thanks again to the Obscure 80s Podcast for playing my promo in their show. I really do appreciate that. And thanks to Jeremy for making the show sound better.
Eerie Radio. Opening the door to the unknown. Listener feedback.
Really looking forward to the new episodes, so keep up with your work, guys. Thanks.
Interviews.
There's so many movies, so many documentaries, even books that come out that have factual information in it, that maybe, you know, this is a gradual way of kind of educating the public as to what's going on.
Visit Eerie Radio at www.eerieradio.com.
All right, well, the first thing that I wanted to get into here real quick was an email that I received from Andy, and he says, "Hi there, I thought I would just drop a line and say that I just discovered the 13 Skulls via the link on Eerie Radio, and I love the show. I'm working my way through the show archive as I type this," which is, you know, pretty flattering to me. I like that. I like to hear that people are working their way back through the old shows, even though I don't think the old shows sound very good, and eventually they might go the way of the dinosaurs. But anyway, he goes on to say, he says, "Now as I'm working my way through the earlier shows, I just listened to your Life is Out There episode that featured a story about a couple of people who experienced missing time during a possible abduction scenario. You mentioned that there are a lot of similarities between many such cases. This could lead to bandwagonism, susceptibility to belief, dreams, or whatever, which leads me to an email that I sent to Jeremy Vaney. I think I've heard that name before, but I'm not really sure. He says, "The following happened to me whenever I was very small, around age 4 or 5, I think. Now, I'm not saying that this was an abduction or even an odd encounter, as I've always put it down to a possible dream. And what I have to say here is that what I'm about ready to read that he explained really does sound like a, you know, an odd experience, to say the least, regardless of whether it was a dream or if it was, you know, an actual experience. You know, it would definitely be stuck with you, being as at the age of 4 or 5, you would definitely, it seems like it would be one of those instances that really is burned into your brain. And, you know, I mean, there's a lot of people out there who claim to have had abduction experiences or anything like that, that really probably never did, that really has just, like he said, jumped on the bandwagon to, you know, to get some kind of attention because they're lacking it in their normal life or whatever. But not to sound mean there, but, you know, people do make up stories for attention. But I don't think so about this. About Andy sounds really, you know, adamant about what he experienced here. So I'm going to go ahead and continue on. He says, "My parents and I moved into a small detached bungalow on new housing built located on the outskirts of a small village, very much in the countryside. Being a new build in an otherwise sparsely populated area, we were surrounded by a collection of fields. One of these fields backed into our garden, which at the time didn't even have a fence marking the boundary. It was a pleasant area to live in, as my friends and I used to play in the fields during the warm summer months, making dens in the corn, which at that age was taller than any of us. The side of the house was kind of a patio door, which opened out to the driveway where our family car would normally be parked. Well, one night I can remember getting up for whatever reason, and I found myself walking down the thin corridor that went alongside the glass doors of the patio, and remember looking out. It was then that I remember seeing a small, dark, frail figure. I recall that this figure also saw me and made its way towards the glass. At this point, I remember trying to run. It was pointless. It was like trying to run through treacle," which I hope I pronounced that right. Treacle is kind of like molasses. You know, it's really thick. I had no strength, and the more that I tried, the more difficult it became. As you can imagine, I also tried calling for help, but my words came out as nothing more than a breathless whisper. Time appeared to slow down, and my energy completely faded. After that point, I can't remember anything else about that night, not even making my way back to bed. As I said, I've always put this down to nothing more than a disturbing dream. But even now, nearly 30 years later, I can still find it difficult to look out a window at nighttime through fear of what I might see and what might see me. As I said, there does appear to be a whole lot of reports from people about encounters with similar entities. If this was just a dream, why is it that so many encounters are similar with people who experience them describing similar beings? Anyway, thanks for such a great show. I've subscribed through iTunes, Andy." Well, thanks, Andy. You know, I can't say enough. Thank you for sending in this experience. I love to hear what experiences people had, which reminds me, I have a few experiences that I've had recently that I need to explain to you guys. So hopefully I can remember that, and I will get to it here in a minute. But, you know, I have to say that when it comes down to it, experiences like these I find to be very intriguing, that you can remember it as vividly as you can, you know, 30 years later. Now, obviously, Andy, you're in your mid-30s, so you have remembered this. You know, if you said this experience happened to you when you were 4 or 5, and you're remembering it nearly 30 years later, I mean, that really made an image. It burned into your brain, into your permanent thought, you know, your permanent memory. And that really says a lot for me. You know, I mean, I can't ever prove whether somebody actually had an experience or not. You know, the only thing I know that is true is what I've experienced. You know, I believe what people have to say, and I believe you, Andy. I think that you probably did have a strange experience like this, but I mean, do you think maybe it possibly could be that you were in some kind of a sleepwalking mode, kind of trance, and you knew you were moving around, but you were still in that kind of unconscious awareness state where you were aware of what you were doing, but not really, you know, because you saw the small, dark, frail figure. Do you think maybe that your brain was interpreting the image of yourself in the glass, you know, that you saw yourself, but your brain was interpreting it in a different way because you were in a mix between your conscious and unconscious, stuck in a kind of a midway point. So, you know, I mean, I know that a lot of times your eyes can play tricks on you. And really, if your eyes don't, you know, your eyes will play, you know, or I'm sorry, your mind will play tricks on you if your eyes don't know what they're looking at. And if your eyes are confused about what they're looking at, then your brain's going to come up with an image that it can closely relate to what you're seeing. And maybe you were seeing yourself, but the image was kind of distorted in the glass. glass and you saw, you know, what you thought to be a small, dark, frail figure. But then again, I mean, maybe you really did see a small, dark, frail figure, and that's why you couldn't run away, that you couldn't, you know, it was doing something to you that paralyzed you, that, you know, some kind of a mental, you know, mental corruption over your conscious or unconscious to keep you where you were so it could interact with you. Maybe it stopped time. You never know. I mean, you did say that time appeared to slow down and that your energy was completely faded. But at the same time, I mean, maybe it could have been that you were having a dream, but yet you were slightly conscious of what your body was doing as far as, you know, whenever they say that you're in some kind of a, you know, when you're in deep sleep, your body goes into a kind of a trance mode where you can't really move too much. And, you know, your body, you feel paralyzed because your body, you know, your subconscious or whatever you want to call it, put your body in kind of a lockdown mode where you can't hurt yourself or hurt anybody around you or get up or do anything while you're asleep. Now, some people do have sleepwalking where they can do this, but, you know, I mean, I had a sister that sleepwalked occasionally, and I've done it myself. And I've been in a state where I've gone and done something and woken up halfway through it. You know, not driving or anything like that, but going in and, you know, going downstairs and, you know, getting a drink of water or something. You know, maybe that was the case, that you were having some kind of a sleep paralysis thing going on, but you had this vivid, vivid dream that you had gotten up and done something. And the reason that you couldn't move and that your energy was faded was because you were still in bed, asleep, but conscious enough to know what your body was doing. I don't know. All I know, you guys, is that it was a really, really interesting story. I greatly appreciate the fact that, Andy, that you sent that in. So thanks again, man. I really do appreciate that. If anybody else has any emails that they want to send in as far as experiences or anything like that, please send them to me. I'd love to hear it. You know, I'll put it in the show. I love experiences like this. Now, I've had a couple of really weird experiences here recently that I'd like to share with you guys. And one of them is that I had a cat that died a few months back. And, you know, I loved this cat. And she was just precious. She was the greatest thing. Now, I have dogs and I have a cat. I had two cats, actually. But anyway, she was a pretty little tabby, and she ended up dying of kidney failure. Well, we put her through months and months and months of IVs and shots and medicines and force feeding, assisted feeding, or whatever you want to call it. And eventually she passed away. And, you know, she used to sit on this ledge at the top of our stairs. Well, you know, she would sit up there, and when she would jump off onto the carpet, you know, on the landing at the top of the stairs, you could hear her little feet, you know, hit the ground, and you'd know that she had gotten down, and you could hear her coming down the steps. Well, not too long ago, just a few days ago, actually, I was sitting on my couch watching TV, and I heard what sounded exactly like her two little feet hitting the ground, or her four little feet hitting the ground. Well, I noticed that both my dogs and my other cat were still sitting. They were downstairs. They weren't up there. Nobody was there. It was just us. And basically, you know, when I heard that, my neck snapped around and I looked up to that ledge. And literally no more than the time that my eyes met that ledge, I saw this little black shadow of a thing sitting there, and then it was gone. I mean, no more than the time that my eyes focused on the ledge, it was gone. Now, I'm probably just putting that up to, you know, a shifting of the house, and, you know, or maybe my mind playing tricks on me, and, you know, my eyes playing tricks on me as well. But, you know, I like to think that maybe she was sitting over there watching over top of us. But anyway, I had to share that with you guys. And another thing that happened, you know, not too long ago is I was sitting out in my front driveway, and I looked up in the sky, and it was a nice, bright, clear, sunny day. And, you know, there's a lot of birds in this area, and that's kind of what I'm putting this off towards. But anyway, I was out there and I was looking up into the sky, and it was a fairly bright day, and, you know, I had my sunglasses on. Well, I noticed this little flicker of white up in the sky, and I noticed it several different times. Well, whenever I went to, you know, look at it a little bit more deeply and, you know, took my glasses off, my sunglasses off, and was looking at it a little bit more, I noticed that there were 15 or 20 of these things up in the sky. And You know, I'm putting it off to maybe being seagulls, like a flock of seagulls, not the haircut, but a flock of seagulls. And because when I would see them, they were spaced out fairly wide over a large area. You know, I'd say maybe a quarter of the sky if you were looking up, you know, here in Texas, it's pretty flat. So it was quite a large area. And I would see flashes of white, and then they would fade away, like kind of go gray, and then they were gone, and they would pick up all over the place, just over and over and over in these different areas, and they were slowly migrating across the sky, which is, again, why I thought it was, you know, probably just a flock of seagulls. But I'm in Texas. There's no lakes relatively close to me. I mean, there are, but none. I mean, seagulls can fly for a long way. Anyway, I don't really know. I just thought it was really weird because eventually they made it to across the sky to a point where I couldn't see them anymore. They had just faded away. They weren't out of sight. They weren't blocked by anything. They didn't go on the other side of a house. They weren't blocked by a tree. It was wide open sky. Now, I'm attributing that to the direction of the sun bouncing off them. You know, the light was different after they got to a certain point. But anyway, I was kind of, you know, just, I was a little, you know, I thought it was a little strange, but anyway, I thought you guys would want to know about that, and, you know, anyway, that's one of my own personal experiences. Now, another thing that I wanted to talk about real quick are some pictures that I'm going to post up on the site whenever I put the show out, and there were pictures that were just given to me yesterday. They were given to me by my supervisor, Kim. Thank you again, Kim, for sending those to me. And they're of this building that we're not really sure what it is. There's no distinctive features on it. There's no, you know, anything that would explain exactly what it would be. But it's a two-story building that has, you know, brick on the bottom and, like, wood shingling on the top. And her, Kim, her daughter, I think it was her daughter, took these pictures, and this building is abandoned. It's taken from several different angles, and she wanted me to review the pictures to see what I could see in them. There's a few pictures that have a lot of orbs. Now, although I know for a fact a lot of people out there are going to say orbs, okay, yeah, that's crap, it's nothing but a bunch of dust. But anyway, I think it's interesting because there's a few pictures that looks like the inside of the orb has a different color to it, like a blue and a green, and some are faded, some aren't, some are pretty solid, some aren't. There is a sequence of three pictures that there's a lot of orbs there, then a little bit lower, you know, a little bit less in the next picture, and then in the next pictures there's only like one or two. And these were taken consecutively, one after the other, within just a few moments of each other. And then there's other pictures of, you know, the outside of the building from different angles, some pictures of the top stories and everything. And Kim had said that she had seen some interesting things in there that she thought were paranormal. And one of them is in a picture that you guys will see that is basically of part of the bottom floor and the second floor. And whenever you go and zoom in to, let's see, which one is it here? Okay, there's one that you'll see it. You'll see kind of a pillar on the side, just a little bit of a brick pillar, and you'll see the two bottom, or I guess the four bottom windows, and then the four top windows. Well, in the top, in the four top windows, if you look at the picture that's all the way over to the left, you'll, I mean, from what we can see, we use Photoshop at work with Anthony, a friend of mine who, you know, coworker, you know, and Kim, and we were taking a look at it, and you can almost make out a face up in the top corner. You have to zoom in really, really close, and it does start to get pixelated. But I thought it was really interesting. It's a creepy little place. They said that somebody had been somebody had died there, and that there were needles and syringes and a mattress inside, and they didn't know if it was a doctor's office or if it used to be a clinic or if it was an apartment complex that was converted into a clinic, or if maybe there was just a bunch of drug addicts that went in there, you know, and somebody overdosed or something. Well, there's bars on the windows in the bottom. There's this kind of creepy brown and whitish colored double doors in the front. Some parts of it are boarded up. You know, it's just a creepy place. I want to see if I can, you know, if we can get an exact location on where this was and see if we can. I mean, there is a warning sign that says no trespassing, but you can't make out anything on it as to why or whatever. But all you can say is, you know, even if you zoom in on it, we tried different lightings on it and all kinds of stuff like that. And basically, you know, we couldn't really get a whole lot, but there is a couple of interesting things about these pictures. There's one that is just of the four top windows. And the funny part is, I guess I should rephrase this. There are no windows in the top floor. There's holes there for the windows. There's long rectangular openings for the windows, but there's no windows in the bottom in the top floor. Or at least from what I was told, and from what you can see in the pictures, there's no windows there. But yet you can see almost what looked to be a cloaked image in one of them, almost of like a figure in a cloak. It's hard to distinguish, but it is there. Again, there's another one that if you look at them, you know, look at it really, really, really close up in the top right corner of the window on the far left on the second story. You can almost see a face there. It's strange, y'all. So anyway, I'm going to post a few of these pictures up here, and I would love some feedback on some people. If you can blow these pictures up and, you know, give me any kind of feedback on what you think they are, or if you can see anything at all, if you can't see anything at all, if you, you know, notice something strange in the pictures, let me know. Email me. I'll let them know. I'll let Kim know, you know, what you guys think. So as far as what you see in the pictures and you think something's really interesting, shoot me an email. Let me know about it. I would love to hear it. I really would. So anyway, I'll post those pictures up. You guys go take a look at them and let me know what you think. One of the first things that I wanted to talk about real quick was recently here in the States, it's been a little while, so I'm sure a lot of people have seen the footage and whatever, but our government here in the United States shot down a satellite, and they shot it down with a rocket, a three-stage rocket, and blew it clean out of the sky because of, I think it was hydrazine fuel or something along those lines that was actually going to be toxic to the environment or the atmosphere or whatever whenever it landed. It was like 1,000 pounds of it or some odd number like that. And I've posted the video up. One of them is courtesy of msnbc.msn.com, and it's actually MSNBC's news coverage of it, and they actually show, you know, a good portion of the video in there. And also I have a YouTube video that is nothing but the military's version of the video, you know, what you can see the stages of the rocket go up and you can actually see something explode. It's not the best footage. It's that kind of grainy night vision optical, you know, kind of stuff going on, and you know, it's nothing spectacular as far as footage, but it is interesting to see and to know that supposedly whenever the government did this, when as soon as it blew up, that it bent the atmosphere of the Earth. Now, supposedly whenever they shot this down, I've read some stuff, and I'll see if I can find the articles and put them in there. If I can't, my apologies, but I'll see if I can find them, about how when they shot this satellite down, it supposedly caused earthquakes and strange things along those lines, storms and stuff like that, which I thought was interesting. If it bent the atmosphere, then maybe it could have, you know, if the explosion bent the atmosphere, maybe it could have done some damage like that. But I don't know. That's kind of pushing the limits for me as far as what something like that is capable of. But then again, if it bent the atmosphere, who knows? Like I said, you can watch the video courtesy of msnbc.msn.com, or you can watch the YouTube video. I'll post the link up to the MSNBC video that you can watch their news coverage on it. And I'll also post up the YouTube video. Now, the YouTube video, to the best of my knowledge, what I can remember watching it, it doesn't have any audio. It's just the footage. You can actually see all three stages of the rocket go up, and you can see this great explosion. You know, from what I understand, nothing was left over that was bigger than just a football. So anyway, again, I'll post these up. You guys go take a look at them, and if you got any feedback on it, you know, let me know what you think. All right, well, the first article that I wanted to cover in this show today is courtesy of godlikeproductions.com, and it's a UFO robot ship that was discovered, supposedly, and it's saying that the machines were here long ago. Now, I'll read the article to you guys, at least a portion of it, and I think that maybe somebody's kind of gone off on the idea of War of the Worlds. But anyway, here goes. It's, again, courtesy of godlikeproductions.com. It says, a possible triangular robotic probe has been discovered entombed in Ordovician rocks. That's Ordovician. 450 million years old? Who knows? Under the Beth Hillel Cemetery near Pine Bush, New York. It is only 7 feet below the current erosional surface, which makes you wonder why they haven't dug it up if it's only 7 feet down. It has been reactivated and is actively sending out signals into space. The History Channel is doing a documentary on this amazing find, which will be aired in February 2008, maybe March. Well, February is gone. I haven't seen it. March is here. Haven't seen it either. It says, word is the previous marshlands were being systematically surveyed by a large unmanned robotic ship that had landed on Earth. While doing a grid pattern survey, a cataclysmic event occurred that the machine was not prepared to react to soon enough and was buried by a significant amount of earth and rock. It's getting out. But Big Corp, I don't know if they mean Big Corp as in there's a company called that or just big corporations in general. It says it's getting out, but Big Corp will probably do the same thing as they did to Mills Hole, which is condemn it and take over, which we need to do a little segment on Mills Hole. It's really interesting. The article that I remember reading about Mills Hole is just unbelievably deep hole that they put, I think, a sheep or a goat or something like that down in, and it came back up dead, like something was getting to it, kind of like the hole dug, you know, to the entrance of hell that I did way back in one of the earlier episodes. Anyway, there's a lot of feedback below the article about this article, so much that I can't even read it all. It's not even funny. It says, one of them says, if this guy can find a robot ship, then why can't he find out how to remove his lens cap before taking pictures and make slideshows of nothing? Which is true. There is no proof of this. You would think that they would have some kind of pictures or something out there documenting, you know, what they found. Another one says, I have a more important question. Why does something with no proof get a pin? another one says, that's stupid. Another one says, War of the Worlds sound vaguely familiar? Basically, the slideshow, there's a website here called Monmouth or Monmouth. I'm not sure how you would say it. It's www.monmouth.com. When you go there, there are some slide presentations there, and a couple of them are blank, I have to admit, but some of them, you know, they're all highlighted. You can take a look at them. I'm not going to place a judgment on somebody's, you know, PowerPoint presentation making skills. But anyway, you know, I mean, some of it's a little confusing. Some of it doesn't look exactly, you know, like it would make any sense. But some of it is pretty interesting. So, again, that's the UFO robot ship that was discovered, supposedly, that's only 7 feet down. I can't understand why, if it's only 7 feet down, why don't they just dig it up? You know, I mean, it's only 7 feet down. That's a little less than a foot longer than I am tall. And how did it get reactivated? It's saying that it's been reactivated and is actively sending out signals into space. Well, first of all, how do we know it's sending signals out to space unless we know that it's emitting some kind of a radio wave or something along those lines? And who reactivated it? How did it get reactivated? That's another thing that I want to know. But anyway, you guys go take a look at it, read the article, read some of the feedback, and take a look at some of the presentations. You know, if you think there's anything of it, or you think if it's all just, you know, crap, you know, send me an email, shoot me a voicemail, something like that. Let me know what you think about the UFO robot ship.
Stewie D never told you what happened to your first podcast.
He told me enough. He told me you canceled it.
No, I am your podcast.
No. No, it's not true. That's impossible.
Search your feed. You know it to be true.
No!
The Obscure 80s Podcast. Two bogus guys. One awesome decade. www.obscure80s.com.
All right, well, the next thing that I wanted to talk about is courtesy of news.nationalgeographic.com, and it's a mysterious pyramid complex that was discovered in Peru. Now, I know it's not necessarily paranormal or anything like that, but I love archaeological stuff. I love ancient stuff. I love stuff that is really, really old that we're just finding today. And to be honest with you, I think it's just interesting. You know, like, I love old stuff. It says the remnants of at least 10 pyramids have been discovered on the coast of Peru, marking what could be a vast ceremonial site of an ancient, little-known culture. In January, construction crews working in the province of Piura, it's P-I-U-R-A, Piura, anyway, discovered several truncated pyramids in a large adobe platform. Officials from Peru's National Institute of Culture, or INC, were dispatched to inspect the discovery. Last week, they announced that the complex, which is 2 miles by 1 mile, belonged to the ancient Vicus or Vicus culture and was likely either a religious center or a cemetery for nobility. The Vicus, V-I-C-U-S, was a pre-Hispanic civilization that flourished in Peru's northern coastal desert from 200 BC to 300 AD and is known for its decorated ceramics. Experts say little is known about the culture because its sites have been heavily looted over the years. The platform, measuring 82 feet by 98 feet, was found alongside one of the larger pyramids in the complex. Another of the larger pyramids contained some artifacts as well as bone fragments from a human skull. The fact that the skull fragments were found several meters below the surface, indicating a deep grave that took much time to dig, promoted researchers to theorize that the individual buried there had high social status. I mean, again, it's nothing paranormal as far as these new pyramids are concerned, or maybe it is. You know, who's to say what is on this planet if we're always finding new stuff? I mean, we are constantly finding new things all the time, but they're not new. They're old. I mean, they're really old. I mean, if this is coming back from 200 BC to 300 AD, then that means that these pyramids were built, you know, 2,000 years ago, from what, 2,200 years ago to 1,700 years ago. That's a long time. To me, that's forever, you know? I mean, it's a long time. And to know that we're able to find these new things is just amazing to me. I mean, we claim that we know a lot about this planet. You know, we also claim that we know the vast majority of the land on this planet, and it's the oceans that we don't really know. Well, that's true. We might know what's going on the land of this planet, but we don't know what's going on below the land of this planet, which is why we're digging this stuff up and finding that there was these new, not necessarily new civilizations, but these new areas that people had lived in the past, which can shed a lot of light onto the history of man and maybe even what we're doing here, why we're here. I mean, I know that's the biggest question in my life is, what's the point? Why are we here? What is the point of being alive? Is it just to be a good person? Is it all a fluke accident? You know, if anybody has any ideas on that or any comments or whatever, feedback of any kind, shoot it to me. But I just thought it was really neat that they found at least 10 pyramids on the coast of Peru. Now, I mean... it's just really, really weird. Anyway, I'll go ahead and leave it at that. If you guys, you know, you got any ideas, feedback, comments, whatever, on the mysterious pyramids, you know, discovered in Peru, you know, let me know.
In a future where noir, cyberpunk, and visceral horror make mind-bending bedfellows, the only thing that separates a forsaken urban sprawl from a half-finished technological utopia is 16 miles of river. They're known as the Failed Cities. Two worlds populated by shadow agents, street soldiers, reluctant detectives, and femme fatales. When a single conspiracy touches them all, the story can only be told in their voices. Ethan, the street preacher. Truck, the hot-rodding neo-hipster, Knifesmith. The Feral Twins, whose passion for death and each other is the only escape from their own tormented psyches. Just a few of the characters that drive one of the most unique storytelling experiences in fiction today. J.C. Hutchins, author of the Seventh Son trilogy, calls the failed city's monologues gritty, imaginative, believable. T. Morris, author of Moravi, says the failed city's monologues creates a chilling tapestry of inner darkness that finds its outside voice. It's not a matter of wanting to listen. You have to. Visit PodioBooks.com to hear the series that's redefining the rules of podcast fiction. Variant Frequencies presents The Failed Cities Monologues by Matt Wallace. 8 lives, 2 cities, 1 story.
Well, the next thing that I wanted to talk about is courtesy of dailymail.co.uk, and it's about a frankenfish. It's about this ugly little bastard of a fish, and pardon my language, but it is. It's one ugly little SOB, if you know what I mean. But anyway, it's the article is entitled Panic After Frankenfish That Is Deadlier Than a Piranha Is Caught in Britain. With its razor-sharp teeth, the fish is known as the giant snakehead, and it terrorizes the warm waters of Southeast Asia, which is why an angler was particularly startled to hook a 2-foot specimen from a river in Lincolnshire. Andrew Alder caught the snakehead using a sprat, which I have no idea what a sprat is. I've tried to figure it out, and I have no idea. If anybody knows what a sprat is, let me know. Anyway, he was using a sprat for bait while fishing for pike in the River Whittam near North Hykeham. I'm not sure how you would say that. Anyway, the article goes on to say he took photographs of his catch and handed them over to experts who confirmed it was the deadly predator, the giant snakehead. It's so devastating that the damage a giant snakehead can wreak on other fish, frogs, and their natural habitat that it's on the list of species that cannot be imported into the UK. It is thought that the fish was smuggled in from a private aquarium and then illegally released into the wild when, you know, obviously it became too much of a nuisance and the people couldn't handle it anymore. But it goes on to say that giant snakeheads caused chaos to an indigenous fish in the environment when they were found living in rivers and lakes in the U.S. in 2002. Snipers with high-powered rifles even set up to watch to shoot the fish as they crawled ashore, and entire lakes were poisoned to get rid of them. Now, first of all, if you're going to poison an entire lake, these things really must be a nuisance. I mean, poisoning an entire lake is pretty drastic. I mean, you're going to kill a lot of wildlife unless you can find a poison that is specific to this type of fish. You know, you're really going to be damaging a lot of wildlife, so I'm surprised that they were able to get away with that. But having a sniper with a rifle shoot these fish, first of all, if these fish can walk ashore, you should just be able to step on them and kill them. You shouldn't have to shoot them with a high-powered rifle. But anyway, go take a look at this picture. The caption under the picture says, known as the gangster of the fish world, the snakehead was caught in Lincolnshire, and go take a look at it. I mean, this all you'll really see is what looks to be, if this is the picture of the fish that's 2 feet long, either it's just one giant head with a flipper, or you're only seeing the head with a flipper, which I think you're only seeing the head with a flipper, but it's one ugly little SOB. I'm telling you right now, this is just one of the ugliest fish I've seen. Has these pretty good-sized teeth that I would think would be, you know, I mean, if it's 2 feet long, maybe quarter inch long, something like that. It's got a pretty good-sized mouth and just ugly, ugly eyes. Anyway, you guys go take a look at it, and if you got anything on the frankenfish that was caught in Britain, let me know. Anyway, that's it. That's the ugly little frankenfish in Britain. All right, well, another thing that I wanted to talk about real quick was in an article that I had looked at a while back. It was about Area 51 being closed down, and possibly having been reopened in Utah as Area 6413. Now, I know that a lot of people out there are going to say, oh no, Area 51 is still lively, still going, still good to go. I don't personally know that. I've never been there. I saw a documentary not too long ago about how Area 51, I can't remember who it was, but somebody at Area 51 had said that they went there and that it was completely and utterly vacant. Nobody was there. Nobody at all. And it's fairly odd old piece of info. So a lot has happened since then. Maybe the military and the government want people to think that they've moved so they can continue to do whatever they do without interference from any of the nosy public. I mean, the military is all about secrecy, or maybe they want to focus on maybe they want people to have the focus on Area 51 to keep attention away from the real secret bases that they have in other areas, such as Area 6413. But, you know, maybe the military doesn't. Maybe we're just all blowing this out of proportion. The military and the government have secret bases, or at least they have to have secret bases that we've never heard of and never will, until there's enough, enough hoopla over it by the public that they disclose it like they did Area 51. It wouldn't make any sense for us to know all the locations of their bases, at least in my opinion. I mean, I heard Stanton Friedman say one time, if you tell your friends, you're telling your enemies, and that's pretty much the truth. You can't tell the public without somebody leaking it to somebody else. And decades of attention to one place leaves a lot of time, and this is Area 51, leaves a lot of time for the military and government to do what they want behind the scenes. You know, they can pretty much do whatever it is that they want. You know, the government is, at least here in the States, is almost null and void from having to claim that they're doing anything. Anyway, the article that I wanted to talk about real quick, I won't go too far into it, is courtesy of think-aboutit.com. And it's Area 51, alive, well, and expanding. I mean, who knows? It says there is no substance whatsoever to the ridiculous rumor that Area 51 and its operations were abandoned and were relocated elsewhere, such as to Utah. Basically, this rumor has originated from what appeared to be a disinformative article that first appeared in June 1997 issue of Popular Mechanics. Anyway, it says that the unexpected article, no doubt, was greatly appreciated by Nellis Air Force Base, and particularly those at the remote operating base at Groom Lake, Nevada. It says the folks at Nellis Air Force Base probably rolled on the floor laughing over the article, which was for the most part filled with factual errors, much to their absolute delight. The June 1997 Popular Mechanics piece also must have brought much delight to the then Secretary of the Air Force, Sheila Widnall. The article, written by Jim Wilson, he's the science editor of Popular Mechanics, inferred that the Air Force had abandoned top secret testing at its once most secret test site. Then Wilson came to the hasty conclusion and stated that we know why and we know where they moved to. Nothing is farther from the truth than this overly generalized inference. But, you know, anyway, there's a lot to this article, y'all. I mean, it's quite a bit of stuff. So if you guys wanted to go and read the whole article and let me know anything about what you think about Area 51 being there or not being there. I mean, do you think Area 51 is still alive and well? Do you think it's expanding? Do you think maybe they moved underground? Do you think maybe they have moved Area 51 and are sparsely using it? They're not really using it all that much. Do you think maybe that they have, you know, moved on to bigger and better places inside of a mountain in Utah, or, you know, underground in Utah, or anywhere for that matter? I mean, maybe they could be up in South Dakota. I mean, who knows? Maybe they could be anywhere. Maybe they could be right next door to Area 51. Maybe they've never moved. Maybe they just went underground. Maybe it's the same operations that have been going on there. I don't know. I thought the article was interesting. There's a lot of infighting, man. I tell you what, I've been paying a close attention to, or at least trying to pay close attention to, the way people treat each other in the world of the paranormal. And, you know, not necessarily in the world of the paranormal, I guess, so much as the way people in general handle everything. I mean, there's a lot of infighting. If someone doesn't agree with someone else, they call them out for it and make them look like crap. Well, you know what? We're all in this together, y'all. We really are. If you're a human being, you're in this with the rest of us. So anyway, I just thought it was kind of funny that all these people are arguing, no, it's there. No, it's not. Yes, it is. No, it's not. Anyway, if you guys got any ideas on Area 51 moving to Utah and Area 6413, if you think Area 51 is functional or not functional, you know, shoot me an email, give me a phone call, whatever you want to do. You know, I'm open for any kinds of opinions and feedback. So just let me know what you think about Area 51 and whether or not it's there. right, well, the next thing that I wanted to talk about is courtesy of newsmonster.co.uk. And it says, have scientists discovered a way of peering into the future? Deep in the basement of a dusty old library in Edinburgh lies a small black box that turns out random numbers. At first glance, the box looks profoundly dull, but is in fact the eye of a machine that appears capable of peering into the future. The machine apparently sensed the September 11th attacks on the World Trade Center 4 hours before they happened and appeared to forewarn of the Asian tsunami. Now, I think I remember hearing something about this a while back about it predicting the September 11th attack 4 hours before it happened, but I'm not sure now. I haven't been able to find anything on that. It's earth-shattering stuff, says Dr. Roger Nelson, emeritus researcher at Princeton University in the USA. But unfortunately, we don't have a box for predicting the future that we can sell to the CIA. We are very early in the process of trying to figure out what's going on here. At the moment, we're stabbing in the dark. So they have this machine that is capable of possibly predicting the future. The article says one of these new technologies was a humble-looking black box known as a random event generator. This used sophisticated technology to generate two numbers, a one and a zero. It says it was used to generate a one and a zero in a totally random sequence, rather like an electronic coin flipper. The pattern of ones and noughts, or one and zeros, heads and tails, as it were, can then be printed out as a graph. Pure chance dictates that the generator should churn out equal numbers of ones and zeros, which produces a more or less flat line in a graph. Any deviation from this shows up as a gently rising curve. During the late 1970s, Professor John hauled strangers off the street and asked them to concentrate their minds on a number generator. In effect, he was asking them to try and make it flip more heads than tails. It was a preposterous idea at the time, and to many still is. The results, however, were stunning and have never been satisfactorily explained. Y'all, I apologize. I cannot seem to talk today. Anyway, again and again, entirely ordinary people proved that their minds could influence the machines and produce significant fluctuations on the graph. According to all the known laws of science, this should not have happened, but it did, and it kept on happening. It's just really, really, this is a long article again, y'all. I have a way of pulling out just really long articles that are just impossible to shrink down and, you know, make a long story short. I just can't seem to do it with these articles because there's so much information there. You know, if people are capable of putting their thought to this random event generator and make it churn out specific numbers as far as more ones than zeros or more zeros than ones, then, and if it did happen to predict the September 11th attacks and the Asian tsunami, do you think maybe it picked up on the collective conscious of the world or who it was that was about ready to get hit right before it happened? But at the same time, it happened 4 hours before it happened. So I don't know. I mean, it's really interesting to know that there's a little black box out there somewhere churning out ones and zeros that's able to predict the future. You think maybe this is one step closer to us actually being able to see what the future holds, or possibly even travel in time to break the space-time continuum or whatever you want to call it. Anyway, I thought it was just a neat article. So it's courtesy of newsmonster.co.uk. You know, if you got any ideas on the little black box, the random event generator, or, you know, any ideas on how science really could peer into the future, or any comments, feedbacks, or whatever, you know, shoot me an email, give me a phone call, whatever, and just, you know, let me know what you think about the little black box in Edinburgh. All right, well, the next thing that I wanted to talk about real quick is courtesy of space.com. It's basically an asteroid collision fueled an ancient dust storm here on Earth. And I thought it was kind of interesting because, you know, if an asteroid collision produced a dust storm here on Earth, do you think that possibly it could ever happen again? Or, you know, what would happen if it happened today? You know, if it happened during this time? You know, okay, anyway, the article says one of the biggest cosmic dust storms of the past 80 million years left a blanket of material on Earth after an asteroid in space broke apart. The conclusion is based on evidence in ocean sediments, which computer models have tied to an observed bevy of asteroid siblings still roaming the solar system. The thinking is that the space rocks were once part of a large asteroid some 100 miles wide that broke up, possibly in a collision out in the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. The drama took place 8.2 million years ago, and I think that's pretty specific. They're actually able to put down a 8.2, not, you know, 9 to 10 million year, but 8.2. Anyway, that much has been reasoned before. The event would have created vast amounts of dust, some which would have been scooped up by our planet. In the January 19th issue of Journal Nature, scientists reported a spike in helium-3, a type of helium that's rare on Earth and typically of extraterrestrial origin, in a layer of sediment dated to that time frame. The dust, rich in helium-3, spiked about 8.2 million years ago and gradually decreased over the course of 1.5 million years. The helium-3 spike found in these sediments is a smoking gun that something quite dramatic happened to the interplanetary dust population 8.2 million years ago, said Caltech geochemist Ken Farley. It's one of the biggest dust events of the last 80 million years. Interplanetary dust is nothing new to scientists. About 20,000 tons of it lands on Earth every year. So does that mean the planet's growing? Like, you know, 20,000 tons obviously isn't that much compared to, you know, the planet itself, but over 80 million years, I wonder how much that would add to the planet's mass. Anyway, while in space, it picks up helium-3 from a wind of material flowing out from the sun. When asteroids collide, most debris wafts through the solar system. Most of it is drawn towards the sun, and on its way, some is captured by our planet Earth. These particles are small and rare, making up less than 1 per million parts of terrestrial sediment. So the new discovery was no easy task. Farley and his colleagues study sediment from beneath the Indian Ocean and the Atlantic, showing that the same event was recorded at two widely separated locations. The long-gone large asteroid has been previously dubbed Varatus or Viridis. It is survived by fragments that roam in orbits that researchers have traced back to a common origin. While asteroids are constantly crashing into one another in the main asteroid belt, said study member William Botke of Southwest Research Institute, only once in a great while does an extremely large one shatter. Computer simulations show the Viridis event could have produced the sudden spike in dust and gradual decline in accumulation. Do you think, what would happen if that much, you know, if that much dust hit the Earth today? Something of a dramatic sense in the interplanetary dust population 8.2 million years ago. What if it happened now? You know, what if there was a great spike in solar dust coming into this planet and more helium-3 was collecting on the planet? Do you think it would have any type of repercussions to our atmosphere or to the life on this planet, be it, a human or a plant? Or a dog, or, you know, anything, you know, ocean life or land life. Do you think anything strange, you know, would happen from all that? Anyway, that's the asteroid collision that fueled an ancient dust storm here on Earth. If you got any ideas about it, comments, feedback, whatever, just let me know about it. I'd like to hear it. Before we move on to the next thing real quick, I wanted to throw in something that pertains to giant, you know, to asteroids, to near-Earth objects. And it's courtesy of jpl.nasa.gov, and that's www.jpl.nasa.gov. And JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory of NASA, has a podcast that comes out, and they cover all kinds of different stuff. They, you know, hunting for molecules, you know, Mars rovers, lakes on Saturn, all kinds of different stuff. You know, talking about, anything and everything that science-related, astronomy-related, anything like that. It's great. Well, I found this one. It's called Making Sure the Sky is Not Falling. And basically, it's talking about near-Earth objects like, you know, asteroids, that type of thing. So I'm going to go ahead and play that for you now. And, you know, just let me know what you think about NASA's podcast and near-Earth objects.
Making Sure the Sky is Not Falling. I'm Jane Platt with a podcast from JPL, NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. Asteroids and comets are pretty cool cosmic objects as long as they keep their distance. Dr. Steve Chesley of JPL is with NASA's Near-Earth Object Office, which uses telescopes and radar to study objects that venture near Earth.
Well, we have about 4,300 near-Earth objects in the catalog at the moment. That's all sizes. We're most interested in finding the large objects, what we consider to be those that can, say, threaten the climate of the Earth if they were to impact.
Those are bigger than 1 kilometer, or 4 times the size of Pasadena's Rose Bowl. Scientists have found more than 700 of those. Most are too far away to pose any danger to Earth. On the other hand, they have identified about 120 objects of varying sizes that do have the potential to hit Earth. Still, no need to panic.
No one knows of a friend or a loved one who has been hurt by a near-Earth asteroid. That's true. So these are very low probability events, but very high consequence events. It's very unlikely that one of these large objects will hit us.
Dr. Don Yeomans heads NASA's Near-Earth Object Office. His colleague, Dr. Steve Chesley, says an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
NASA's approach to the Earth hazard problem so far, and I think rightly, has been to focus on discovery. You cannot deflect an object that you haven't discovered. And so finding the asteroids, finding them early, is the most important thing in this process.
So the Near-Earth Object Office, with input from astronomers around the world, detects objects, tracks their location, size, speed, and movement over a period of time. They rate them on the 10-point Torino scale, sort of like the Richter scale for earthquakes.
Torino scale 0 is where 99% of our cases fall, which means that it's just not worth any public attention, although we continue to monitor these routinely. Torino scale 1 means it's more than ordinary, but still not particularly alarming. We get, on average, a few, maybe several Torino scale 1 cases per year. We have had a couple of Torino scale 2s. We even had one Torino scale 4, which was quite extraordinary.
Now, a 4 is enough to worry about, but with more detailed observations, the 4 and the 2s were downgraded.
After an object is discovered and observations continue to arrive at our office, we continue to update and refine the orbital predictions and the impact assessments. That allows us to refine the Torino scale ratings for the object and so on.
And so far, every single worrisome object they've tracked with further observations has been ruled out as a hazard to Earth. Interested in keeping tabs on these objects? Check out the Near-Earth Object website at neo.jpl.nasa.gov.
We have the impact probabilities, and you can click on any one of the objects and get details. But at the top level, there's a summary for each object. The speed at which it passes the Earth is present there, and that, of course, is important for the impact energy, the size of the object, and the Torino scale.
Again, that's neo.jpl.nasa.gov, and it includes a lot of links. In case you're wondering what would happen if scientists did find an asteroid that really could threaten Earth, researchers are scoping out different ways to handle a scenario like that.
Probably the best and most obvious way of deflecting an asteroid is to simply slam a spacecraft into it and to slow it down or speed it up if you overtake it from behind. And that gives it enough change in velocity to steer it off the Earth-impacting trajectory.
But again, none of the known near-Earth objects have scientists staying up nights worrying. So for now, they say, the sky is not falling. Thanks for joining us for this podcast from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory.
All right, well, I thought it was kind of interesting what they had to say about, you know, about near-Earth asteroids and things like that. I know that it's not necessarily paranormal, but it's something that I find to be interesting. And again, I'm going to throw in stuff in this show that I want to hear about. Now, I know that a lot of people want paranormal stuff. You want ancient history. You want, you know, ghosts and things like that. Well, you know, I wanted to throw this in there because I find that the universe is the most puzzling thing of anything. I mean, the paranormal is puzzling in its own ways, but I like astronomy too. I like space stuff. I love stuff like that. So anyway, if you got any ideas on near-Earth asteroids or near-Earth objects or anything like that, you know, shoot me an email, phone call, something like that, and let me know what you have to think about that kind of stuff. All right, well, the next thing that I wanted to talk about is, in my opinion, the most graphic, disturbing, gross, whatever you want to call it, thing that I've ever talked about on this show. So I'm going to go ahead and warn you guys right now that if you have a weak stomach or anything along those lines, then you're going to want to go ahead and fast forward through this to, you know, to the next topic, the next subject, and, you know, just not listen. Plus, you really don't want to visit the site. But for the rest of you who have a strong stomach and you can look at this stuff in a scientific way, or you can just look at it in a, you know, a demented way, like, you know, watching a train wreck, you just can't take your eyes off of it. Anyway, it's courtesy of think-aboutit.com again. And there is a warning at the top. It says the bottom of this page contains very graphic photos of Brazilian human mutilation victims. Do not proceed if you are not prepared for these very shocking photographs. There are three human mutilation reports on this page. I'm going to read you a little bit from the beginning of the article, and then we'll get into the photographs. By G. Cope Shellhorn, this article was written. It says, if this case is authentically UFO-related, and at this time I have no reason to believe it is not, then all of us are going to have to reevaluate to one degree or another our tentative conclusions as to the possible specific intentions, moral perspectives, and general agenda that some of our extraterrestrial visitors may have. Now, for anybody out there who's ever seen Fire in the Sky, thanks, Jeremy, for letting me know about that movie. Anyway, if anybody who's ever seen that, and, you know, you can get an idea that they're not exactly the kindest things in the world, these little aliens, you know, abducting us. Anyway, the article goes on to say, there have been rumors of homicidal UFO-related human mutilation cases for some time now, but hard evidence has been lacking, until perhaps now. Brazilian ufologist Encarnacion Zapata Garcia, I hope I said that right, and Dr. Rubens Goes have recently presented a series of sensational photographs obtained from police files which mimic the wounds of countless UFO-related animal mutilation cases that have been reported in Europe and North, Central, and South America since the 1960s. On first glance, they would seem to be ufology's worst nightmare. The article goes on to say, what is more disturbing is that the Brazilian ufologist, and I don't know if you guys can hear this, I'm going to stop this real quick, but you can hear one of those big helicopters going over my house. I don't know if you can hear it or not, but I tell you what, man, those helicopters have been flying over my house forever. They get so loud, it's ridiculous. They're like 200 feet off the ground, and those big helicopters aren't very quiet, man. Anyway, sorry, I'll get on with the article. It says, what is more disturbing is that Brazilian ufologists and police have intimated that there may be at least a dozen or more cases similar to the recently uncovered Guaraparanga Reservoir case. If this is true, it is somewhat doubtful that any of this potential new material will ever see the light of day, given the official attitudes now prevailing in Western power circles. But we can be grateful for fortuitous disclosures, and the Guaraparanga case and its accompanying photographs seem to be just that, a great stroke of luck, albeit a dismaying one. Okay, you know, there is just a unbelievable amount of article to hear to read. The vast majority of the whole page is nothing but an article. Now, down at the bottom below all the pictures, you're going to see something. It says, the complete set of the forensic color photographs and the autopsy report proves that the typical cattle mutilation type of wounds were inflicted while the victim was alive and conscious. It is a horrible fact that, due to its implications, must be divulged in spite of the shocking spectacle presented by the photographs. And there's a disclaimer down there by the guy, I guess, who has the site that says, I have made no claims for the accuracy of this information and express no personal opinion of the matter. The information was acquired off the web and from authors and other sources and described as information, and I just wanted to pass it along to anybody who might find it interesting or otherwise useful. So anyway, when you scroll down after the article, if you finish reading it, there's a little caption above all the pictures says, these are the photographs from the Brazilian human mutilation case. Again, warning, very graphic. Anyway, let's get into discussing these real quick. All right, the human mutilation case of 1994. There are two cookie cutter, in quotes, wounds on the chest. The eyelid was removed. The eye was removed. The ear was removed, the lips were removed, the side of the jaw was removed, the jawbone itself was removed, and there's no blood whatsoever. Now, these photographs, first one you're going to see is what looks to be the back of the head with an ear missing. The next one down, you're going to see, now these cookie cutter wounds, I'm just going to talk about these cookie cutter wounds that they're talking about. are pretty, I mean, there's no blood around, and they almost look like they were burned into the body. They almost, because, I mean, if you're burning somebody with a blowtorch or something like that, you're burning flesh with it, it's going to cauterize. It's going to keep it from bleeding, so I can see where that would happen. But there's black around, like it bruised really bad around this, around the holes, and one of them looks to be right just above the armpit where the bicep muscle would connect with the tendon to the shoulder. And, I mean, he's got a cookie-cutter thing in his leg, and, you know, it's almost kind of weird to see. The body almost looks like it's been burned, especially the forehead. You can definitely see where the lips and the skin around the face was removed. The arms look black as can be. You know, I mean, this guy's got a lot of hair in his body, but, you know, anyway, it looks like a lot of it was burned. I mean, even his genitalia is all burned up. It's gross. And there is a little bit of blood. There's one picture you're going to see where the hole around his shoulder is, where his bicep is. There's a little bit of blood that leaked out there. So not having any blood whatsoever, not the case. There is a little bit of blood. Not a whole lot, but a little bit. And you can also see there's a couple of pictures down here of where his sphincter has been removed. They pretty much tore that right out, cut it right out. But there doesn't look like there's as much blood as what there should be. It's weird, you guys. Got to take a look at that. You got to have a strong stomach. It's just weird to think that, I mean, maybe somebody did this to a person to make it look like an alien abduction, or to maybe make it look, I mean, maybe they were getting rid of evidence by cutting his lips and stuff off, but you'd think they'd cut off their teeth or whatever. But anyway, I thought it was just really, really, really weird to know that a cattle mutilation would occur to a human. But anyway, you guys, go take a look at these photos. And again, they are very disturbing. I mean, but I can look at it in a scientific way and it doesn't really bother me, because I think it's interesting that something like this would happen to a human being. And if another human did it to him, man, you're messed up, dude. Seriously, if another human did this to a person, it's just weird to see. So anyway, you guys go take a look at these photos if you got a strong stomach. If not, just fast forward on. Don't take a look at the link, and I will talk to you on the next subject. But for the rest of you, go take a look at them, read the articles. Let me know what you think about the Brazilian human mutilation cases. I think it's disturbing, but it is good. It's interesting in a scientific way to know that something like this can happen. But anyway, you guys go take a look at them and let me know what you think. All right, well, the last thing that I wanted to talk about is courtesy of offroaders.com. Now, I don't know if any of you guys out there, and I'm sure some of you have and some of you haven't, ever seen the movie Silent Hill. Well, the movie Silent Hill is actually based on a true place. And the article is courtesy, again, of offroaders.com. I'll put a link to it up, you know, in the show notes, and you guys can go take a look at it. And it's about Centralia, Pennsylvania. A Pennsylvania community consumed by an underground mine fire. In the heart of the anthracite coal region in Pennsylvania, you may have come across a detour of 61 at the top of a hill community called Ashland. Thinking nothing of it, you would have followed the detour signs that took you around some possible road construction or a bridge being worked on. You're then reconnected to 61 again. Many have followed this path in recent years with little knowledge of the ongoing story of this little detour in the town that is no longer really a town. If you had disregarded the detour signs and make the right that 61 North takes through Ashland, your first clue that something isn't right would be the abrupt end to Route 61 as it once was. This road closure seems to be more than just a little construction up around the bend. At closer inspection, it would seem to be a more permanent close of the road. If you were to look to your right and follow a small, slightly less engineered road down and around the closed Route 61, it would reemerge at the beginning of the story in Centralia. The ruins of Centralia, Pennsylvania no longer exist on some maps. The story began sometime in 1962 along the outskirts of a town when trash was being burned in a pit of an abandoned strip mine, which connected to a coal vein running near the surface. The burning trash caught the exposed vein of coal on fire. The fire was thought to be extinguished, but it apparently wasn't when it erupted in a pit a few days later. Again, the fire was doused with water for hours and thought to be out, but it wasn't. The coal began to burn underground. That was in 1962. For the next two decades, workers battled the fire, flushing the mines with water and fly ash, excavated the burning material and dug trenches, backfilled, drilling again and again in an attempt to find the boundaries of the fire and plan to put the fire out or at least contain it. By the early 1980s, the fire had affected approximately 200 acres, and homes had to be abandoned as carbon monoxide levels reached life-threatening levels. An engineering study concluded that in 1983 that the fire could burn for another century or even more and can conceivably spread over an area of approximately 3,700 acres. That's a lot of land, y'all. 3,700 acres is a big area. As time passed, each feeble attempt to do anything to stop the fire or help the residents of Centralia would cost more and more due to the fire's progression. Over 44 years and $40 million later, the fire still burns through old coal mines and veins under the town and surrounding hillsides on several fronts. The fire smoke, fumes, and toxic gases that came up through the backyards, basements, and streets of Centralia literally ripped the town apart. And it did, too. There's a couple pictures there where you'll see where the road has completely split and there's steam or smoke, coming out of the crack. It's really quite creepy. But anyway, this thing burned for 44 years. It's just insane. Most of the homes were condemned and residents were relocated over the years with grants from the federal government, but some diehards have decided to stay in the town. Today, Centralia is virtually a ghost town with only a few remaining residents. As they continue to live in their beloved homes now owned by the federal government, people pass every day along 61, mostly tonally unaware of the history surrounding them and the sad story of Centralia. It really is, there's a couple of then and now pictures where then, you know, it's a thriving little community, cars driving up and down the road, parked on the side of the road. Now there's nothing, no cars, no nothing. Holes in the ground. There's this one picture that shows a little dirt road going along. It kind of drops off on the right and kind of levels off on the left, and there's smoke coming up from every which direction you can see. They have a huge big siren, kind of like in Silent Hill, which is why this place was an inspiration for it. But it's really quite strange. They have gas monitors hanging around. The streets are just abandoned. Now, I want to read a little bit of the mine history of Centralia real quick. Again, the fire started in a garbage dump in 1962. In July of 1962, the Department of Environmental Resources started to monitor the fire. Boreholes were drilled to check the extent of the fire, the extent and temperature of the fire, but some also thought that those boreholes that they drilled also provided a natural draft which helped the combustion of the coal keep it burning. You know, they installed gas monitors. Basically, pretty much everybody moved out. But, you know, in 1980, the U.S. Bureau of Mines Red Book said the Centralia mine fire has not been extinguished and has not been controlled. Within the year, 27 families had moved out by 1980. The ground collapsed under Tom Domboski, a hole about 4 feet wide and about 150 feet deep opened underneath him. And he actually got a hold of a couple of tree roots and pulled himself to safety along with his cousin helping pull him out. It says by 1983, the government said the fire was advancing on three or four fronts. Proposing trenching of the area might cost as much as $660 million with no guarantee of success. That's a lot of money to spend on something you can't guarantee that you'll be able to fix. One of the larger trenches would have bisected the town roughly from east to west. A government buyout was proposed instead of the trenching. The homeowners voted to accept the buyout. There's only 11 people left in this town. 11 people. It says in 1983 there was a fire under about 350 surface acres. By 1991, this had increased by 3/4 of that. So 350 acres plus 3/4 of 350 acres, which, I mean, close to 600 acres? It's crazy. Worst case scenario would be about 3,700 acres and a possibly 100 years worth of this fire burning. Finally, they had to buy out pretty much all the houses. There's just a few diehard people there now. Like I said, there's about 11 people that live there. It's really kind of a sad story to know. My dad worked in the coal mines in West Virginia a long time ago. My mom's dad worked in the coal mines for a long time. So it's kind of sad to see these people's community just get ruined by an accident, more or less. I mean, I know they weren't intentionally trying to do this, but you know, it's a sad event. But there's some really creepy pictures here. There's one that's kind of an aerial picture that shows you more or less like a neighborhood that is just it's dead, and there's all this smoke coming from all these different areas, just pretty much taking over the whole thing. It's really kind of creepy to see how this town is just abandoned. I mean, nobody really drives through it anymore. You know, the stories around what happened here vary depending on who you talk to and what you read. It's never going to be the same, that's for sure. It's really quite odd. It says studies have shown that if the fire is not contained, it will continue to spread following the rich coal deposits and eventually threaten the neighboring town of Ashland, less than 2 miles away. It's crazy to know that this could encroach onto a different town. But a lot of people, says some believe that the rich deposits of coal beneath the town itself is the reason for the forced relocation of the town's people and to force the town to go debunked, giving up its natural mineral rights. The stories around what is happening obviously vary to who you talk to and what you read, but maybe it is. Maybe the government's letting this burn. Maybe they're saying they can't fix it to be able to say, okay, your town is defunct, you need to move out, we get the mineral rights, which means they can dig up whatever they want, they can sell it and make the money off of it. Nobody in the town gets anything better. So, you know, maybe it is a government conspiracy to keep this burning. I know it wasn't intentionally started. Maybe it was, who knows? But, you know, I think it was an accident that it was started. But who knows? Maybe it is, maybe it's a government conspiracy to keep it burning so the whole town can go defunct so the government can make some more money off of it. If that's the case, if that's the case, that's sad, man. That really is. That's pretty sad. But anyway, you guys go take a look at Centralia, Pennsylvania, the inspiration for the movie Silent Hill. And there's all kinds of links to, all kinds of different stuff involving the town. You can go take a look at the mine fire history, pictures from today, historical photos, a scientific study, satellite aerial photos, personal notes from people, just all kinds of different stuff. Anyway, I want to do a little bit about the inspiration for Silent Hill. So since the first Silent Hill game back in 1999, fans have wondered, is there a particular town that inspired the haunted wastelands we've come to know and fear in the Silent Hill games? There have been many speculations, and now here's a place where you can actually visit for real, and that is Centralia, Pennsylvania. In researching the different elements of Silent Hill, screenwriter Roger Avery, who also did Killing Zoe and The Rules of Attraction, came across the town of Centralia, Pennsylvania. It says that when they were looking for something strange or different, Centralia planted the seed for what developed in the cinematic version of the town Silent Hill. The problem wasn't really acknowledged until a series of accidents in the 70s and 80s, including the appearances of sinkholes hundreds of feet deep. In 1984, Congress allocated more than $40 million for relocation efforts, and residents moved to the nearby Mount Carmel and Ashland. Anyway, you can find a lot more information on this at offroaders.com. I will provide a link to it in the show notes. You guys can go take a look at it and let me know what you think about Centralia, Pennsylvania, the inspiration for Silent Hill. All right, you guys, there's one last thing that I wanted to do a little bit of talking about here. And that is the fact that my supervisor, Kim, my boss, made up some buttons and magnets that are 2 1/4 inch, I think, around 2 inches, 2 1/4 inches of the 13 Skulls logo. And I want to give some of them away. So what I'm going to do is that for the first few people that shoot me an email with, the 13 Skulls buttons or whatever you want to put in the title, the subject line, whatever, the first few people that send them to me, shoot me your address and I will ship you one so you have one. And specify whether or not you want a button or a magnet. They're both on, they're both 2 1/4 inch. One of them has a pin on the back so you can stick it to your shirt, and the other one has a button you can throw it on your fridge. But if you guys want one, let me know. Now, I do have it, just a limited amount. A very, very limited amount, just a few of each. If you guys want one, the first few people to shoot me an email with your address and which one you want, the button or the magnet, I will ship them out to you and get them to you as soon as I possibly can. So if you guys want a button or if you want a magnet, shoot me your address and I'll mail them to you. But you got to be quick. You got to be real fast. You got to jump on it like there's no tomorrow, because I've only got a few of them. And, you know, who's to say they could go fast? Who's to say nobody might want one? I don't know. I'm just doing this just for fun, just to get the word out there, to give some people some you know, something to hold on to instead of just the podcast. Anyway, if you guys want one, shoot me an email. Again, tell me what kind you want, whether you want the button or you want the magnet. Please, just one a piece, you guys. I can't really send out any more than that for each person. But if you want a button, tell me you want a button. If you want a magnet, tell me you want a magnet. Tell me your street address or PO box or whatever you want me to send it to, and I'll ship it out to you so you can have a button that has the logo or a magnet that has the logo for this show. Anyway, and I might be getting some other stuff. There might be some more gear coming you guys' way. It just depends. I'm going to have to give some more thought on it. Anyway, but, you know, I hate to say, you guys, I think I'm going to have to wrap it up. I'm going to take one last break here, and we'll go ahead and close the show out. All right, you guys, I hate to say this is the end of the show. We're going to go ahead and wrap this up. Again, I appreciate you guys coming and listening to the show. I want to give a shout out again to the Obscure 80s podcast at obscure80s.com and to Jeremy Ball for making this thing just, you know, sound a whole lot better. So again, that's obscure80s.com and jeremyball.com. There's links to both of them. I'll provide you, and there's links in the sidebars. But 13skulls.com and the 13skulls.podomatic.com. So anyway, if you guys want to shoot me an email, it's the13skulls@gmail.com. Don't forget to put the T-H-E in there in the beginning. It's T-H-E-1-3-S-K-U-L-L-S@gmail.com. The phone numbers are 206-338-2205. Also, the new phone number is 817-986-0019. So anyway, I really appreciate you guys coming and listening to the show. If you want, sign the Frapper map. I'd greatly appreciate it. I'd love to know where people are at. If you want to give the show a vote, there's a links on both the sidebars for the Podcast Alley vote to give the show, you know, a little bit more credit. Also, you know, if you guys want to go give a review on iTunes, I'd greatly appreciate that too. But anyway, you know, you guys do what you do. I hope you have a great day, night, week, weekend, whatever it is that you're listening to the show. And as always, again, I will talk to you guys on another day.